Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Sony Pictures, presenting All the King's Men. Sean Penn leads a cast including Sir Anthony Hopkins. All the King's Men is in theaters September 22nd.
Extraordinary men who have addressed in their own different ways the moral crisis of our time. Our second session this afternoon will cover the years 1963 to 1968. As the Civil Rights Revolution came to a head and U.S. involvement in Vietnam deepened, it was a tumultuous time, a time of great contrast between political advances for civil rights and growing fragmentation in the movement, progress toward the vision of a great society, and increasing polarization of the country over issues of war and justice. And on January 25, 1965, Dr. King exhorted his supporters and the whole country by reminding us that, quote, "We still have a long, long way to go and that there are dark moments in this struggle, but often the darkest hour appears before the dawn of a new fulfillment." Dr. King and Robert F. Kennedy entered these dark moments searching for the dawn of a new fulfillment. We have another outstanding panel of speakers to take us through these 5 years. Marion Wright Edelman, to my immediate left, grew up in the segregated town of Bennettsville, North Carolina, and later became the first African-American woman to be admitted to the bar in Mississippi, where she directed the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund office in Jackson in the mid-1960s. In 1968, she was recruited by Dr. King to be counsel to the Poor People's March that he began organizing shortly before his death. In 1973, she established the Children's Defense Fund, which has become the most powerful voice ever created for millions of poor children in the United States. She's been honored all over the world for her lifelong commitment to civil rights and has received the Robert F. Kennedy Lifetime Achievement Award for her writings, which include 5 books and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest civilian honor. Peter Edelman was legislative assistant to Robert Kennedy during his 4 years as U.S. Senator from New York. Earlier, he served as law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg and worked in the Department of Justice in the Kennedy administration. The New York Times review of Peter's book, Searching for America's Heart, RFK and the Renewal of Hope, describes his work with Robert Kennedy this way, quote, "For 4 years as a campaign and Senate staff member, Peter Edelman was at Kennedy's side on a journey of discovery into poverty in a nation in tumult. He witnessed the riveting scene when Kennedy first met Cesar Chavez, the farm worker organizer. The Mississippi Delta, investigating the hunger and malnutrition that existed in much of the rural South at the time. And on that trip, he met his future wife, Marion Wright. Quote, "I was extremely impressed," he writes, close quote. As you will see, this is my comment, quote, "She was really smart and really good looking." Peter Edelman is now a professor at Georgetown Law School, a prolific writer, and a continuing activist for social justice. As you can see, I went a little bit out of order for a particular reason there. Elaine Jones, sitting between Marion and Peter, is one of our nation's foremost civil rights lawyers. After graduating from Howard University, she served in the Peace Corps in Turkey and then became the first black woman to earn a law degree from the University of Virginia. After law school, she turned down an offer to join a prestigious Wall Street law firm and went to work for the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, first as a trial lawyer, then as legislative counsel, legislative advocate, and finally, and most recently, recently as director counsel. She's had an extraordinary career in the courts as a lawyer for death row inmates, victims of employment discrimination, and other civil rights clients, and in the legislative arena as one of the chief architects of the Voting Rights Act amendments of 1982, the Fair Housing Act, and the Civil Rights Restoration Act of 1988 and the Civil Rights Act of 1991. She's been a teacher and mentor to hundreds of young civil rights lawyers and has been a guest lecturer at many law schools. The moderator of this panel will be Juan Williams, one of America's leading journalists and a frequent speaker at the Kennedy Library. As senior correspondent at National Public Radio, Juan's reporting and commentary bring special insight to the news and are heard by millions of listeners across the country. A former editorial writer, op-ed columnist, and White House reporter for The Washington Post, and a frequent television commentator, Juan is also the author of the several critically acclaimed books, including the bestseller Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965, the companion volume to the award-winning television series. So please join me in welcoming to the stage of the Kennedy Library Marion Wright Edelman, Peter Edelman, Elaine Jones, and Juan Williams.
Thank you very much. We're going to try to do things a little differently than the first panel in that we really want to have you get a sense from these people on the panel about the personalities involved with Robert F. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr. This is a period, 63 through 68, that really features so much in the way of turmoil. And if you think of turmoil as revealing something about the character of a person, testing that character, we have a rare opportunity here this afternoon to hear about the personalities that came to the forefront that met the challenges of their day. I'm talking about in 1964 things like the controversy at the Atlantic City Democratic Convention with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. We're talking about the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 64. We're talking about the deaths of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. You move on to 65 and you get into the era of Selma, the Voting Rights Act, and of course riots. And of course then we go on in that way. So I wanted to start by asking the panel, beginning with Marion Wright Edelman, to tell me a little bit about Martin Luther King Jr., someone that you knew personally, worked with personally. How would you describe King to these young people today?
I know Dr. King for 8 years. The sit-in movement in Atlanta occurred in March after the Greensboro, North Carolina sit-ins in February. Dr. King came to speak in the Spelman College Chapel in April of that year, and he had an indelible impact on the students who heard him. One of the things he said was about the importance of moving and movement. If you can't fly, run. If you can't fly, drive. If you can't drive, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl, but keep moving. And the second thing I remember from that first speech as a young person sitting in Spelman's Chapel was him talking about taking the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole stairway, but you take the first step and you leave the results to God. And one of the things that impressed me very much about Dr. King was that most of the times I saw him, he was depressed and didn't know where he was going next. And he was one of the few adults whom we admired very deeply, who could be uncertain, who could share his fears, who could talk about his uncertainties. And that has been an enormous help to me throughout my life. The second thing I remember about him was how accessible he was. I mean, I go back through my diaries and I see how many times he met with me, took time with me and other young people. First plane ride I ever had to Raleigh, the SNCC was formed, was Ella Baker got us all together to go up to Raleigh, and he spent the whole time listening and being there. And the number of times he met when black students in Atlanta in 1960 decided to not give in to the threat of Ku Klux Klan about marching across town to Wheat Street Baptist Church. He showed up unexpectedly to greet us on the other side after we had gone on to do things. He was a man of enormous courage and taught about courage not being the absence of fear. Just don't let it paralyze you. Just keep that struggle going. And so he had an enormous impact over that 8 years. Robert Kennedy I got to know personally only in the last 15 months of his life. I had obviously known about him long before, but he came to Mississippi with the Poverty Subcommittee, which people will probably talk about, Joe Clark Subcommittee, to investigate charges into the poverty program that Senator Stennis had levied and challenges to Head Start program in 1965 in April. April 1967. And I thought I was going to talk about Head Start, but what was on my mind was hunger, and the fact that there were starving and malnourished babies. And so I talked about that and then asked him and the senators to come up to the Mississippi Delta, and he said he would, and he did. And it transformed my view of Robert Kennedy, because I had not been a great fan during the earlier years, because I had known about him during the McCarthy era, I had known about the King wiretaps, I had known about the judges that had been appointed, which were not of the same kind of judges that the Eisenhower years had been. But when I saw him go into those Mississippi Delta homes and sit outside of camera range with hungry children with bloated belly, and saw his moral outrage and saw his determination to act, it was a very moving thing. I wish we could. We need Robert Kennedy today, but he went back to Washington. He pushed Orville Freeman. He sent Peter back down with Orville Freeman, who didn't believe there were people in Mississippi with no income. And so we retraced the bounds of the previous trips, but he was a fearless, tireless pusher to deal with the problem of hunger in our country, which he was shocked by. And I think one of the lessons from that era was how hard it was to move our country to do what was right for the hungry and the poor, and with Vietnam detracting us, even with the kind of advocacy and the media that Robert Kennedy could command, but he didn't go away. And last, I would just say that he and Dr. King came together and I felt privileged to be able to be the glue that I think led to the Poor People's Campaign, because in one of the trips to Washington, in the aftermath of his earlier visits to Mississippi, and I'd kind of gotten to know Peter and kind of liked Peter and realized he wasn't an arrogant, cigar-chomping, you know, fellow. But he was, on a visit with him, we went out to Hickory Hill and met with Robert Kennedy sitting around the pool. And he heard me update him on the frustrations with how slow change was in Mississippi and what we could do about it and how everybody was being distracted by the Vietnam War and how do we make the poor visible. And it was still going on, and he was frustrated with the pace of change on hunger. And I mentioned that I was on my way back to Mississippi, but I was going to stop in Atlanta, as I often did, to see Dr. King. And he said, well, go tell him to bring the poor to Washington and to get in Lyndon Johnson's face, bring them and make them visible. And so a couple of hours later, went by and saw Dr. King in his very unprepossessing office on Auburn Avenue, and he was depressed, not figuring out what to do. This was after a lot of struggles in the northern efforts, and he was frustrated, but I went and told him what Robert Kennedy had said about bringing the poor to Washington, and he lit up, and he said, you're like an angel who's delivered a message, and I've always felt so grateful to have been an angel between Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. But that led to Martin Luther King thinking and then beginning to deal with his very strong-willed and rambunctious staff about why we should have a Poor People's Campaign. And for me, the convergence of the two was the move towards substantive civil rights, to trying to begin to put the economic and social and educational underpinnings beneath the earlier civil rights struggle. And so it was a watershed effort that led between the partnership of the two to the Poor People's Campaign.
What a wonderful start. Thank you, Mary. So let me turn now to the other dominant personality in that relationship that Marion just described, Robert Kennedy, and ask Peter Edelman, how would you describe Robert Kennedy to these young people?
Well, I'm just so pleased to be here, and especially with Ethel Kennedy, my dear friend. Robert Kennedy was somebody who was absolutely determined. There's so much that we could say. We could be here for hours and days, and we've had these discussions here on these premises, but particularly talking today about Dr. King and about civil rights and as Marion just said, about the transformation of the issues through the 1960s into the intersection between civil rights and poverty, which is the part of the question of civil rights that we have been least successful in dealing with over the decades since. If there was one thing about Robert Kennedy, he always said one person can make a difference. If there is one phrase that we remember about him, and he so admired individuals who he met, when it was my privilege to go around the country and just be there as a witness and to help a little bit, when he met Cesar Chavez, when he met Marion, when he met others who individually were making a difference, that was what meant the most to him. And that's what he modeled for everybody. That's what he did in his life. I think he got up every day. And, of course, as a staff person, it was a little frustrating because you'd have a terrific day and you'd get something done, you know, whether it was working on some, getting an amendment to a bill in Congress or whatever, because he was in his role as senator basically the whole time I knew him. And the next day it was like you hadn't done it. You had to start all over again because you had to make a difference the next day. And you didn't stop and say, well, wasn't that great, and pat yourself on the back and all of that. So that was a very forceful part of a very characteristic part of RFK and working with him. He was funny, and everybody that worked for him was part of the family. And so it was a very informal office. And another characteristic is that he was a listener. He was a person who learned. He certainly was a reader. He always had a book with him when he was on a plane or wherever he was going, and he loved the Greeks, and he read philosophy and literature and history and so on. But every one of his senses worked equally. And so it wasn't enough to read a book about something. He had to go and see for himself. He had to go and touch and listen. And so it was of course, the objective fact was that he went to places where no United States senator had ever been, no presidential candidate had ever been. But that was about him. That wasn't about politics, because that was the way he learned and connected. So walking into the home of one of those families, of all of those families in Mississippi that were where the children were hungry, to the people who'd been coal miners and lost their jobs in eastern Kentucky and on Indian reservations and farm workers, all of that. It was about listening, and not about telling them what he was going to do. It was about listening. The relationship between Robert Kennedy and Dr. King, of course, goes back to the beginning and to the subject matter of the previous panel. And I just want to say this. I think maybe it's obvious, but it was a relationship of discomfort, and it should have been. Because Dr. King and everybody associated with the civil rights movement wanted things to move faster, and sometimes they did and said and asked for and pushed for things that were inconvenient for the politicians. You know, I'm busy. I've got to deal with Khrushchev. Well, yeah, you do have to deal with Khrushchev. That's pretty important. But so is justice. So is ending segregation in the United States. And so a lot of the time, Robert Kennedy was the one who was saying to the movement, to Dr. King and the others, you got to slow down. You know, don't send those freedom riders. Don't sit there in jail down there in Birmingham. You're making things inconvenient. But then, story after story, where after he had tried to get them to kind of slow down, he was there. Associates were there, the president was there to be responsive, to get King and others out of jail, help do that. So discomfort. Now, the last thing I want to say, and I know you'll have a lot of other questions, is that the relationship between Senator Kennedy and Dr. King during the period that I knew Robert Kennedy was not very extensive. They knew each other. There had been the past discomfort, which may have contributed. But the real point was RFK was now a senator from the state of New York, and he was doing that business, and he was a national senator, and he was an international senator. But he was doing what he was doing as a senator, and they were working on parallel lines. And the most important fact about their relationship is that without being in some sort of joint plan, they were both They both saw how wrong the Vietnam War was and worked on it, and Dr. King gave his famous speech at the Riverside Church, and Robert Kennedy said many things and did many things that were important about that. And in terms of the question of civil rights and poverty, they both saw what not enough people in our country saw then and what not enough people in our country see now, which is you can't have a meal at that lunch counter if you don't have the money to pay for it. And that is a continuing challenge in our country. Why are African Americans and Latinos poor at a rate of 23% and whites are poor at a rate of 9% in our country? And so that was something that was going on where they were both headed in the same direction, and it wasn't as though they had to do it in a way that involved conversation all the time. There were letters back and forth. Dr. King came and testified at the Ribicoff hearings on urban poverty. But the real point was that they both understood that working for racial justice means working for economic and social justice.
By the way, why did he hire you, Peter?
Beats me.
I mean, what'd you say to him?
Well, the first thing is I was lucky enough to be working for a wonderful man who... Ethel and I and many of us loved John Douglas in the Justice Department, who was the head of the Civil Division, and I'd gotten there because I had a clerk for Justice Goldberg who had said, go to work in the Kennedy administration. It's the best administration you're going to see in your lifetime. And I was like, wait a minute, Franklin Roosevelt, I remember him. But there was something a little prescient there. Anyway, as a consequence of being in the Justice Department, right place at the right time, the accidents of life, and a little interest in politics, I got involved in his campaign for Senate, and then afterwards he offered me a job on his staff.
All right.
I could tell you that story, but that...
No, we'll come to it.
Yeah.
Now I want to come to Elaine Jones. And Elaine, you were a student activist during this period. The way I think of it is this is a crucible period when really you're seeing so much going on. There's so many pressures, so much happening, and it forms the Elaine Jones that becomes a superhero to this generation. But I wanted to ask you from your perspective then, as a leader in the student movement, someone who's closer to the streets, who understands the kind of turmoil in terms of riots, dissatisfaction, discontent on the streets, what did you think of these two men? How would you describe your view as a young person of these two men to these young people?
The messages of the three of them, of JFK, RFK, and Dr. King, resonated with my generation. I mean, I was, you know, I'm born in the segregated South. And so I knew what they were talking about when they were talking about the daily indignities. I lived through it, and you know, the back of the bus and the separate water fountains and the colored signs, and you know, so I always said, even from a child, this, you know, I'm in America, this is wrong, you know, and I need to play some role in this. And the point that they would make, you know, generally to anybody who listens, is that, you know, it's a point Peter just made. Any one of us can make a difference where we are. And so I was a high school student when President Kennedy told us, you know, ask not, you know, what the country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And that resonated. When I went off to Howard University, Martin Luther King came to the campus. He came to Howard, spoke at Charter Day in 1962 to all of the students. You know, Stokely Carmichael and I were in the same class, and I mean, that class of in Howard in the early '60s. You know, was really a cauldron of activity. Kids going back and forth, going to, you know, different missions, and mine. I was from Norfolk, Virginia, and so, you know, we had our few little sit-ins. You know, but it was nothing. You still didn't feel as if you were really part of it all, but you were absorbing it. And so when Lyndon Johnson gave the Great Society speech, it was to my graduation class. And there again, You know, I heard that. And so the idea was, how could I take what I wanted to do, this thing of law, and make it work to bring about some social justice? And so I you know, the campaign, the whole idea of the Peace Corps came up through the Kennedy administration. So I went off to Turkey. I mean, after 3 or 4 years, you know, I just packed up. I said, well, maybe it's better over there. And so from 65 to 67, that's where I was. I was in the Peace Corps teaching at the University of the Medical College in Istanbul. So, you know, and then over there, Robert F. Kennedy had a 1966 speech in South Africa, in Cape Town, that was a riveter. And somehow, through the Peace Corps mechanisms, we heard about that, the speech of getting an exhortation of becoming involved. And so that's why when I came back and I enrolled at the University of Virginia Law School, they had not had African-American women. They had only 3 African-Americans, period. I said, look, I'm from Virginia. I'm going to apply. If I do not get admitted, then Thurgood Marshall will have a test case, or the legal defense will have a test case, but I'm going. And so Virginia, I said, and if they don't admit me, then they will pay my tuition at some other university, which was to practice in the South, even then. And so that's when I went there, and I decided I was going to not be run out of UVA. I was not going to be a statistic. I was going to graduate. And so when I got the job on Wall Street, Mr. Nixon's law firm, Wall Street, I said, I can't do it. I can't, because I can't look myself in the mirror. And it was paying $18,000 a year then. That was big money, big money. So I can't do it. And so I called up Jack Greenberg at the Legal Defense Fund, and I started litigating death penalty cases throughout the South. And so, you know, that, and so throughout, so my 30, 35 years as a lawyer has been informed by the lives of these 3 men. And I met Martin Luther King once, only once, and that's when he came to Howard in 1962.
So what'd you think?
Oh, you know, I often wonder why it is when you take on these issues of social justice and equal rights and civil rights, why it is so all-consuming. We use you up. We don't leave anything left for you. You know, he was tired then. He was always tired. You know, I understood. But he was tired of rest deprived. And that's what we do. We ask people to lead, and then we say, we want you to give every last measure while you lead us. And you may be consumed because of that leadership. And then after they've given their last measure, we forget to follow through.
Chip in here because... This period of 63 to 68, and I would just say from 1960 to 68, or from the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement when we were all conscious of Dr. King, for me, was a period of great hopefulness and great transforming change. I did listen very carefully. I realized I met President Kennedy in 1961 in my first year in law school, because I had heard the call and asked not what you can do for your country, but what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I went on Crossroads Africa, and our group went to the White House, and John F. Kennedy spoke to us the day before we were going off to Africa. But this period where we had, as a young person, and I've always felt so grateful to be born, who I was, where I was, when I was, with the convergence of great leaders and great transforming events. It was really a period, in my view, like Seamus Heaney says, that when history, where hope and history rhymed, because we had an outlet for youthful frustrations, always hated segregation, always hated being contained. And so Dr. King, in a sense, opened up new outlets. You had President Kennedy giving new senses of hope that change was possible, new energy and new vigor. And then you had Robert Kennedy coming on the scene, and it was a period of great hopefulness. You had new legislation. And I think that the lessons that began to emerge from the speech in Washington, the Civil Rights Act of 64, as a student in the sit-ins, you know, public accommodations were opened all over the place, and the Kennedy Justice Department was on the right side of moving that along. And so I think that the lessons from this period was how possible transforming change is, and for a young person who'd grown up in a totally segregated state to see the walls of apartheid begin to crumble, both through the courts, starting with Brown and then the Montgomery bus boycott. I think it taught us that how hard change is. And what I love, and I try to distinguish between the first part of the 60s and the second part of the 60s, was a sacrificial witness that was provided by all. I mean, John Kennedy obviously was killed, so were the next two. But we had examples of adults and young people and children being willing to sacrifice everything to bring about change. So the old notion of cheap grace and quick fixes. And then third, I think we learned about the importance of multiple roles. Peter says an uncomfortable relationship, but Robert Kennedy had a different role as Attorney General in his brother's administration, and he was trying to control the agenda, but Dr. King had another agenda, trying to push the administration and to transcend the law. And I think the fourth thing that I come from this was to watch how people can change, because I think to watch and to get to know Robert Kennedy in those last years was very, very moving. And while Peter's emphasized how much of a listener he was, Dr. King was also a listener. He was unbelievably patient in listening to young people and Stokely. I remember the Meredith March, and every night after the march, we would all gather, and Stokely would gripe, and everybody would gripe, and Dr. King would sit there, and that's when Black Power began to come forward, and he would say, "Is it so bad, Stokely? Is it that bad, Stokely?" But night after night, and his stricken face, when one got to Greenwood and Willie Ricks got up and started yelling Black Power and using that, and then in Jackson, the same thing, but he constantly listened. In addition to listening, Robert Kennedy was somebody who was insatiably curious. And boy, would he ask all kinds of questions all the time. What are you reading? Every time. I don't think I ever saw him in that last 15 months, but he would not ask, "What are you reading?" Even had the nerve to ask me in the car, "Who are you dating?" I said, "It was none of your business." But I also associated Robert Kennedy, and it was very moving in those last months. Didn't know him in the earlier period, Ethel.
Let me say that we want to look at an intersection that comes between these two characters.
Okay.
We have some tape of Robert Kennedy speaking as news comes to his campaign while he's in Indianapolis of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. So I'm going to ask that tape be played. But you spoke about this as an optimistic period. I must say that if you look back on it, you can look back on this as a period that seems rather dark. You have the president's assassination in 63. You move forward and you have Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. You have riots. You have the whole rise of the Black Power movement almost as a result of alienation from the political process and the sense of optimism about the possibility of peaceful social change. In addition to which, there's this ongoing discontent in terms of riots in the big cities that's sweeping the country that will lead to some political response, crime and law and order and all the rest. So I wanted to ask you about the dark side of this picture, but first I was hoping that we could hear what Robert Kennedy had to say in his unusually elegant form that day. And it really picks up on something you spoke about, Peter, which is his love of the Greeks, because you hear it, you hear that language as you hear him speak here.
I have some very sad news for all of you. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
So you could see there some evidence of that kind of sadness. And, you know, I wish that we had the opportunity to hear the entire speech, because it is an amazing presentation. But I wanted to ask each one of you, beginning here, Peter, with the impact that you felt from the dark side of this period and what we saw of the character of Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and King.
It's a complicated decade, certainly one of the most unusual and filled with change of all kinds of any decade in our history. Of course, the decade of the Civil War, and we went through World War II, and we went through the Great Depression, so that there have been other momentous times in the history of our country in which both the greatness of our country manifested itself, and there was terrible tragedy. And that is a character, that is a fact about the 1960s. Marion was starting to say that it kind of divides itself into two halves. I'm always troubled, to be honest with you, when I read those who read, which is tends to be people who come from a different political place than I do, who read the 60s as a time of counterculture and drugs and long hair and hippies and things being out of control, and as well as what I think you were getting at, which is the changes that occurred within the civil rights movement, where there was a move from inclusion to exclusion within the movement, which was deeply troubling to many people. It was a time there was horrible loss in so many ways, but so much achievement. And that's what Marion was talking about. So much, and you know, someone will ask, and so I will answer badly, but I will answer the only answer that there is to the question, which is, what do we do without those three great leaders? What do we do in a time when we don't have leadership like that? And the answer is, we have ourselves. And we can hope that people will come along who we can follow. But when we've lost leaders of that caliber, we still have ourselves. And if we don't, everybody in this room and everybody around the country, with all that's going on in our country and the world, if we don't take personal responsibility, one person can make a difference. If we don't take personal responsibility and get together and organize and make those waves that multiply on out, we have only ourselves to blame.
Elaine, let me Elaine, let me come to you with the same question. Here's a period where you do have people turning away from nonviolent social change, becoming involved in violence, where you see the sense of disorder. Did it drain the optimism from you?
If it had one, I wouldn't have spent the next 35 years in the courts trying to make a difference. The 60s were it was the first time that I can remember, really, and I think that this country had a national conversation on race. It had never happened before. We had the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the courts, you know, all talking about race. Now, I didn't always like what they were saying about it, but we were talking about it. And because that, we have yet to be healed in America. And so it was important. And when you look at the 60s, the civil rights laws on which we rest today, 2005, were passed in the 60s. And it came out of that destruction and that chaos and all of that activity, and a lot of positive things went on. People realized they could impact on their present and their future for their families. The 64th Civil Rights Act, you know, Juan, the importance of that. You know, it's critical. The public accommodations, education, the whole thing. The 65 Voting Rights Act, you know, critical. And the 68 Housing Act. You know, and that, and we never get civil rights bills enacted into law in periods of calm.
Well, let me follow up on that with you. But you also get then, after Robert Kennedy's death, you get Nixon's victory.
Backlash, the reaction.
Well, tell me.
I mean, point, counterpoint. What happens, you know, I think President Johnson had it right when he signed the Civil Rights Act. He said, you know, we're turning over the South. And what is happening, it's been the South, really, it was Democratic. It was the cold words. And eventually, the South, in a backlash, I think, to a lot of the progress made in the 60s, you know, over the course of the next 20, 25 years, became solidly Republican. Race has a lot to do with that. Look at the politics, racial politics. Divisiveness wins elections. They learned that. And so that is what has happened. We've been pitted against one another for political gain.
Now let me, Mary, let me come to you with just the same thing, but let me put it in a more personal context. If Dr. King had lived, if Robert Kennedy had lived, do you think, one, Robert Kennedy would have been elected president and defeated Nixon? And two, do you believe that it would have changed then the sort of political agenda that we've seen? Well, without a doubt, it would have changed that political agenda. So let's stay with the first question.
Of course he would have beat Nixon. and of course we would have brought about different change, because after the depression of Dr. King's death, we still had Robert Kennedy, who ended up being assassinated and dying on my birthday, in fact, in 1968. But we had hope. Let me just say that a lot of things happened after the chaos of their deaths. And Dyke Elaine, who went off and continued to try to keep planting seeds in racial discrimination through the courts. I went off and started planting the seeds after the Poor People's Campaign, which has resulted in expansions of Medicaid, the child health insurance. There are 25 laws in the book that weren't there, and I want to just tell you that during the Nixon years, because of what Robert Kennedy and MLK put into what they began, because change is hard and it takes a long time. You know, we had the largest expansion in child and family nutrition programs during the Nixon years because of the chain of events that had been begun by Robert Kennedy. And so food stamps, which is today our major safety net program, serves 25 million people, and another 20 million are eligible. That all happened because of what Robert Kennedy and Dr. King, and they triggered the McGovern Committee and the Doctors from the Field Foundation. But during those Nixon years, significant progress was begun to be made, despite all the bad things that happened. But I think that we need to look now at the last 30 years where the seeds were planted in the Civil Rights Act, and look at the millions of children who have health care, who have child care, who have a Head Start. Dr. King dropped in when Head Start was being threatened in Mississippi and was called an outside agitator by Sarge Schreiber as we were struggling for refunding. But the fact is, Head Start has moved from $375 million to a $6.5 billion program. And so the change didn't stop. And in many ways, it was, you know, it was spurred on by our looking at the sacrifice that had been made, our seeing what was possible, and our determination to move to the next stage of movement building, which is the intersection of race and poverty.
Let me ask people in the audience to line up to ask some questions about this period. We have about 10 minutes to go. But as we do this, I just wanted to follow up on something you said, Marion, which is you look at all the program, the policy and programmatic efforts that have borne fruit, but you didn't mention President Johnson. And I know that historically there was a great deal of tension between Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Why didn't you mention Lyndon Johnson?
Well, I mentioned Lyndon Johnson because in many ways it was, he was, you know, we wouldn't have a lot of the civil rights laws and the war on poverty, but that was the, you know, the 1960s. The OEO and the poverty program and the Head Start, which made the next step from where we were in Mississippi in 1963 or 64 in the Summer Project, it became the salvation of the lifeline in many ways in Mississippi, and it was out of Head Start that we ended up having the kinds of hearings that led to their awareness of hunger, which led to their awareness of the need to try to talk about proactive social and economic underpinnings for children and for all people. But Lyndon Johnson was obviously a very crucial actor, but by the time we got to 1965, the war in Vietnam was distracting him. And so it was because of these extra voices of King and Kennedy that we were able to push ahead on the poor, even as they were also raising their voice against the war in Vietnam. I guess the last thing I would just simply say, I just remember so vividly, you know, not only RFK's speech, but the...
Why don't you stay next to the microphone?
The day after Dr. King was shot, going out into public schools in D.C., and having an 11 or 12-year-old boy whom I was telling kids not to loot and not to go out and ride, and telling them they would ruin their future. And I remember this little boy looking me straight in the eye and say, "Lady, what future? I ain't got no future. I ain't got nothing to lose." But secondly, the presence. I mean, Robert Kennedy and Ethel, I don't know if you remember this, walking into the inner city right after the riots, going to Walter Fauntleroy's church, being present, walking down the streets that were still simmering, that presence of leadership. But somehow one never lost hope, because I guess what one had come out of the, you know, Brown didn't start in 1954, Charlie Houston, all of them began a long time ago. I've always had this 40-year view of transforming change, and I've seen it. We've got to move on to the next period of transforming change, but it takes lots of seeds and lots of sacrifice. But you honor that sacrifice by keeping going, and we've learned that struggle can pay if you just don't give up.
Peter, did you want to jump in on that about the relationship with LBJ?
Well, I think Marion said it. I think we should give LBJ the credit that he absolutely deserves. If you read all of Caro's books, to some extent, you have to wonder why. We never completely understood why he cared so much about civil rights, but he really did. And the groundwork had been laid by the movement and by President Kennedy making the proposal in June of 1963. But Lyndon Johnson went to Howard University and said, "We shall overcome."
That's right.
Lyndon Johnson said that. And it was on his watch that largely and partly in memory of President Kennedy, but the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, the finishing up of the creation of the legal rights, and efforts, you know, that were flawed, but between the Great Society and the War on Poverty, all of those laws and programs are still on the books. Medicare and Medicaid, Elementary and Secondary Act of 1965, now messed up with No Child Left Behind, and efforts across a number of different areas, and so he did a terrible thing by expanding the war in Vietnam, but let's give appropriate credit as well.
Lane, did you look like you've tired out that microphone?
I just want to say on Lyndon Johnson also. You know, he continued, he really worked on trying to desegregate the courts. I mean, and he understood the importance of symbolism, although Thurgood Marshall was much more than a symbol. But, I mean, Lyndon Johnson had to expend a whole lot of political capital, you know, on getting him on that Supreme, up to the Supreme Court. And before that, you know, President Kennedy and Robert King getting him on the Second Circuit, you know, Court of Appeals. I mean, it took a lot of energy to get that done. And Constance Baker Motley, who we just lost, I mean, she went up to the court during that period. So they realized, you know, that civil rights lawyers could also be judges, because that hadn't been understood before. And so we thank them for that principle.
All right, so let's go to the audience. Let's start over here on my left.
Mr. Edelman, Mrs. Edelman, Mrs. Jones, you all have unique perspectives into the worlds of law, politics, civil rights in the United States. You're good too, Mr. Williams. How would you say that the position or the attitude of politicians have changed since you guys started and now? In their attitudes towards race and equality.
Okay, so this is a question about the politics of race and and how it's changed from that period that we're discussing today, and we'll throw in the parameters of the first panel, so we'll go back to the election of President Kennedy in 60. If you were to go from that period to now, and I think this is really an appropriate question, given, Peter, in your response, you mentioned how there was tension that between the civil rights activists and the politicians in terms of the rate of change, and we know that from Elaine's comments that sometimes people, I'm sorry, it was from Marin's comment, that oftentimes people were disappointed even in Robert Kennedy in terms of the judges that had been appointed or the decisions that had been made. So what's the difference between, let's say, Robert Kennedy, the politician of that period, and the kind of politics we see now with regard to race?
I think you have to talk about the underlying views in the country, Juan, so that it's interactive. You know, the people who hold office are the people who got elected to office. And so I think that we got a lot of work to do. One thing that I think is tremendously, has enormous potential, this is a very different country in terms of who's in this audience compared to an audience 30 or 40 years ago. We've had huge immigration into this country that I think has wonderfully enriched the United States. And so when we talk about race as an issue, as much as we still have a serious agenda for full equality for African Americans, we're talking about Latinos and people from all parts of the world who make up the diversity of this country. And I think that has tremendous political implications that we haven't realized as yet. So I would view this as a transitional time. This is a bad time politically. And so what happened about race specifically is it became a no-no to say the N-word. And you know, you couldn't stand in the schoolhouse door anymore, and you couldn't make comments about all the niggers I know being fat and happy, which is something that Governor Ross Barnett actually said publicly in Mississippi. So you're not allowed to do that anymore, and the consequence has been a politics where it's a euphemism. You know, it's been a politics of crime and welfare, where we end up after all that legislation, after we shall overcome with over 2 million people under lock and key, disproportionately African American and Latino in country. And if you don't, in this country, if you don't think that's a racial issue, you're on some other planet. So what's happened is we've had a change in all of that, and we just need to get back to what I said before, which is to get to work in using the assets we have, which is ourselves.
Well, let me ask Elaine to chime in here, because if you look at the numbers, Elaine, you see, for example, in terms of voting for President Bush, if it was just, you know, it's a matter of not only white men, overwhelming support of white men for President Bush, it's also, I think, majority of white women voted for President Bush.
I'm sure a lot of them want that vote back. But what has happened, though, to us in the past 30 years is it's been racial politics. We have been bombarded with racial to divide us. You know, this group against that group, you know, throwing out buzzwords, quotas. I mean, just, and it has won elections. I mean, and it's been practiced and it's developed. Now it's a fine art. What we, the people, have to do, we have to do it. We have to turn this thing around, because, and we can do it. Looking at Bob's issue, Bob Moses raised the question about quality public education. It is not in the Constitution. You don't find the word education in the Constitution. It's not there. Now, it's almost beyond race and our divisiveness and our narrowness. It's about us as Americans. You know, can we compete? Can we be a united society to hold on to and develop our greatness? We can't do it if we do not educate all of our children. All of our children. And so what we have to do is we have to educate our neighbors and our friends and say, you can do all you can for your child and your grandchild, but that's not going to save us. That's not going to save us. You have got to be concerned with these kids who do not have access, who do not have resources, but who have brains that can be developed. And we've got the money. We've got the money, but we don't have the will. And we have to start holding these politicians accountable when they come to us using buzzwords and talking about the death penalty and gay rights, which is peripheral stuff that belongs in the states anyhow. They aren't federal issues. They aren't issues that the executive branch deals with, but they use it to get votes. And so we need to hold them with our questions, and we need to stay on it. And it's not just the level of the presidency and the Congress. It starts with our folk at home, local folk. And it's what the students did in the 60s, and we've got to take that back now and take those lessons and apply them to the first part of the 21st century.
All right, so Marion, let me ask you not to answer this question so we can get another question from the audience.
Yes, hi. Let me start by explaining something. My stepson was killed in Iraq. He was a lance corporal for the United States Marine Corps. And we're a Hispanic poor family, I guess you could say. And two of the things that we found out very much after the fact, we're also a family, a blended family or a divorced family, we found out after the fact was that he was targeted by the recruiter, first of all, for being Hispanic, and second of all, for being poor. That's information that is given unless you can opt out. Okay, so that's been more than a year since that has occurred. And my husband and I have been working with peace activists, but there's something missing. Okay, I grew up in New York, okay, and if there's part of the rainbow's missing, it's not a rainbow. Okay, and it doesn't give me hope. And it's been mainly the black community and people of color of other languages have been missing. And I was wondering if each of the speakers could give a tip, a simple tip, because the thing back then in the 60s was that there was less technology available, but a lot of grassroots, simple things that were done that's missing today.
So let me get this straight. You think that in terms of the anti-war movement, anti-Iraq war movement, am I right?
Right.
That what's missing is a sense of interracial support.
Definitely.
For instance,
the March on Washington, that Cindy Sheehan was pretty much all white, and then the Million More March was pretty much all black. Why?
Okay, so who wants it? Marion?
Say one, the seeds of what has to be a cross-racial, cross-class movement were again planted in the Poor People's Campaign, where Dr. King brought white, black, brown, red folk together for the first time to put a face on poverty that was not just black, and not just inner city and not just Southerns. And the next movement has to be cross-racial. May I just say, I'm so sorry about your son. And it is always poor minorities who are recruited, children, both. For war, and also we have this phenomenon called the cradle-to-prison pipeline, and our children are being rooted into a pipeline to prison. Prison is the new slavery. A black boy has a 1 in 3 chance of going, who's 4 years old today, has a 1 in 3 chance of ending up in prison. And the disparate application of laws in our juvenile justice and criminal justice system result in a white young person being, a black young person on a drug offense, being 48 times more likely to go off to prison, and a Latino young person being 9 times more likely to go off to prison for the same offense than a white young person. And so we've got to deal with the growing criminalization of our children across race and class. But I want to give a little hope, because there is a lot of cross-racial stuff going on. There are a lot of young leaders who are meeting all around the country. This time last Sunday, for six hours, young Latinas and young black and young Asians were meeting in my office with Harry there. We have had down at Haley Farm young Asians, all kinds of young people are coming together because we have been quietly trying to convene young people to try to be the kind of role model in mentoring. Every summer, Freedom Schools are being run by 1,000 young people, Latino, black, brown, and so there's a lot that's going on in communities and a great recognition by many that one has to talk about a movement and new leadership across race and class.
Well, Marion,
it's happening.
Your comments will raise 3 questions for
yep.
me. The first one was Harry who?
Harry Belafonte, sorry.
Okay. And You didn't mention whites.
Whites are engaged in everything. I mean, again, I want to tell you there's an awful lot of work going on in many networks all over this country with whites, blacks, Latinas, and Asians, and at the adult level and with young people, but also trying to get structures for advocacy and service and for change, because change is much more complex now.
All right, let me ask Elaine, though. Elaine, I want you just to kind of go right to the nub of this question. If you look at the march, the anti-war marches, the Cindy Sheehan type of events, you don't see people of color. Why?
Let me show you the glass half full answer to that question, which is there were marches. That was the march on the war in Iraq. And I mean, it was well attended, and it was there, and the activism, and those citizens came to Washington and were seen. And a few weeks later, you had another march. And they were from the Washington Monument all the way to the Capitol. Thousands and thousands. Thank you. Thank you. So my point is the half of the activism is returning. It's coming. Now the point you're raising, yes, but now let's get some diversity within it. And that's the easy part, because I'm telling you, I was at the Million More March. I was not. I had just come back into town the day of the Iraq March, and I'm telling you, every time I saw a march, I was honking in support. But now, why wasn't I there? That's something maybe I need to talk about. I know I applaud every time I hear that the recruiting numbers are so low in the black and brown communities. They just can't get the young men and women to sign up. And I said, right on, getting the message. You know, so that's progress to be made. The diversity is going to come, but let's continue with the activism, because it's important.
All right, next question.
I guess my question will go specifically to the point of when I hear all of you talk about the 68 and all that was going and the energy, it's very inspiring. But what to me is less inspiring and something I trouble with is the image of black males nearly absent from this audience and in many other places I go. How then is it possible to take that energy and focus then and bring it now, so that that image that I see on TV and the very low expectations of black males in this country change?
You mean when you say that image you see on TV, you mean like sort of the either the minstrel show comedian or the rapper or the...
Well, for instance, several years back when the Susan Smith put the children in the car and put them into the water, and she'd announced that it was a black male who did that. It wasn't that she announced that. It was how quickly people were to believe that. During the floods, when they were talking about babies being raped and drug addicts running around, it wasn't that they said that. It was how quickly people were to believe that. And it leaves one group to bear the burden of that, and that is black males. So I'm wondering, how do you bring that focus around? Media plays a huge part in this too.
I absolutely agree. I think that as the father of two young men, I lament the images of young black men, not even apart from the idea of the images it broadcasts to the wider society and to the globe, but the images that it reflects in terms of how they would self-identify, what it means to be black and to be a black man, takes on, I think, some very negative aspects. But let me ask anybody in the panel who wants to jump in here.
We've had, particularly in the inner city, the discussion sort of implied it when we talk about the cradle-to-prison pipeline. We've had 30 years since these neighborhoods that used to be economically integrated, even if they weren't racially integrated, became heavily poor. I mean, and we know what's happened along the way. And so for better or for worse, in the 1990s, the country decided to get after welfare moms, Reed Black, also Latino. And it's a policy that I, as many of you know, I disagreed with pretty strongly. But, you know, the the fact is it happened at a time when there were jobs available in this country, and so while people didn't get out of poverty, single moms actually went to work in pretty large numbers. In other words, we had a policy badly designed but turned out not as bad, still bad, for women, especially Black women. We had no policy for Black men except sending them to prison. So I would start by answering your question by saying we need this conversation. The percentage of young Black men with a high school education or less, 18 to 24-year-olds, who are working during the 90s, the prosperous 1990s, went down from 59% in 1990 to 52% in the year 2000. Nobody's talking about that. I mean, I would think that number is probably a surprise to most people in this room. And so we have to talk about the why of that, which I think has a great... maybe some other things, because it's pretty hard for a fellow to find a job when he gets out of jail. And we can get there, but it really means, number one, calling it out, doing what just what you did, and starting to put it out there and to make our elected officials talk about it and address it as well, and our schools, Bob Moses. You know, if every child in this country has a right to education and we follow up and implement that, and we talk about who isn't getting a good education, then we're going to be talking about that subject. So it's a long haul, because we've sunk a long ways.
Mary, let me come to you and ask you to pick up on just what Peter's talking about, the education part, because I think that what we know is about 50% of Black children who enter the ninth grade do not get a regular high school diploma. Some get GEDs, attendance certificates, and the like, but don't get a regular diploma. The second thing is the high percentage of Black children in single-parent families, and what I take to be the consequence, tremendous negative consequence for young Black men. Do you see that as part of the problem?
Oh, I do see that as part of the problem. But you know, many Black children, and particularly Black men, are born with three strikes against them in terms of the intergenerational transmission of poverty, the absence of health care, the absence of jobs, the absence of health and mental health supports, schools, early childhood investments. And so by the time many of them get to school, they're already years behind. There's a Kansas City study that said by age three that looked at the children of academic parents and the children for welfare mothers and said that there was already a 30 million word gap by the time they got to age three because of interaction. You can't teach what you don't know. And early Head Start serves only 3% of the eligible children, and Head Start serves only 50% of all eligible children. So this absence of early stimulation from parents who themselves were poor and not stimulated and can't transmit new levels of achievement to their children is...
Mr. Now with our questions and answers, if everybody will help me out.
Yeah, Mr. Question. Juan Williams, this question is for Madame Marion Elderman. My question is, in 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he went to Washington for his first civil rights rally. In that rally, he did his famous speech, "I Have a Dream." And I hear that speech all the way to South America, Costa Rica, and I still remember that speech myself. How this speech changed the movement and the American people? My other question is...
Wait, hang on. Let's just do one.
Okay.
Let's just do one. Who wants to talk about the King speech, 63, "I Have a Dream"?
I think I went to that I Dream, that march in Washington. I drove my little beat-up Beetle with Bob Moses and Ella Baker and Jane Stembridge, and we stood there and we yelled our heads off because somebody was giving enormous public voice to what we all felt within. And so he gave words and a sense of reality to our dreams. And so it was a very, very moving and validating occasion. It was then led to new kinds of violence and new kinds of challenges, but it was one of the watershed movements in the civil rights movement, and it had all kinds of people coming together to express their dream of America across race and class, and so it was a very important occasion.
Peter, let me just say, but of course the Kennedy administration didn't embrace that March on Washington initially. It's only after its success that I believe King is invited into the White House with some other civil rights leaders.
That's part of the discomfort that we talked about. You know, it was from their point of view, wrong schedule, pushing too fast, and so on. And of course, everybody here knows if you want change, you don't listen to the people who are in power telling you to slow down. You have to keep on.
Yeah. Okay. Next question.
What can you tell us about the relationship between Dr. King and Malcolm X?
They were beginning to talk again at the end. Malcolm X was the other wonderful part of one's life growing up. Again, the luck of having all these people in your life as a young person, and how I felt when I first heard Malcolm X come to Yale Law School. And he knew me. There were very few of us at law school, but he pulled out and knew everything about me, that I was from Bennettsville, and we had people from my little rural town who were in his army, and he gave a speech that was brilliant and angry, and I would go and speak to him, and he would talk about the silliness of trying to follow nonviolence, and he was trying to recruit people into his movement. And he dealt with the anger side, even though on the women's thing and on lots of other stuff that I wasn't going there, but it was a very important, again, time when one could find adult leaders speaking what we felt and giving us choices about which way we would proceed to change the struggle. And I think he was changed in the last years as he went off to Mecca and began to run into difficulties, and the two began to converse more.
But let me just come back to the question, though. I think there's one picture of them together, I think. There's a single picture when they met at the Capitol. Oftentimes they were posited as representative of violent struggles by any means necessary versus the apostle of nonviolence. They really didn't have a whole lot of interaction, except I think Malcolm at sometimes saw himself as a threat. Peep saying to people, if you don't deal with Dr. King, you're going to have to deal with the kind of anger that I represent in the society. So your view is, though, that they were actually working together.
No, but that at the end, that Malcolm was changing, and that there was more openness there in an effort to reach out to Dr. King, so that everybody grew. I mean, again, that's one of the lessons, that everybody can grow.
Okay, next.
You wrote about Juan. He also reached out to Thurgood Marshall.
Absolutely.
When he came back.
It's a different Malcolm at the end, although I find young people relate more to the pre-Mecca Malcolm than they do to the transform Malcolm. It's very interesting.
And most of us relate to the dream than to the uncashed check or the bankrupt check to the Dr. King speech in 1963, and we need to go back and read the whole speech and pay attention.
I need to ask people to really ask brief questions because we're so close to being out of time. Please, go right ahead.
I just wanted to say that today it's been said that the success of the civil rights movement has caused the South to turn Republican and have gone into the hands of Republicans. Today those lines between blue and red states are drawn very fiercely. I mean, if you were to tell a Republican and a Democrat today that a Republican and a Democrat are running for election and that's all you tell them, they're going to vote according to party lines instead of taking the third choice of abstaining from the vote. I mean, George Washington said, our first president said that he warned against the party system because it clouds the issues and leads to misinformation. So I just wanted to know what your opinions on the party system in relation to JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King's success has been.
Okay, let me just ask Peter to answer that question.
that's a complicated question. You know, I think that we just need to have... Paul Wellstone, my dear, wonderful friend of ours who we all lost, used to say that he was from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. So I think if the Democrats were out there presenting candidates who were from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, there would be some clearer choices, and there would be some different different politics. Now, that's only a tiny answer to you.
Well, then, so wait. So, okay, so let's say you had the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. Why wouldn't you then have a successful third-party movement in America?
The way in which our electoral system... Well, if John McCain runs as an independent in 2008, you might see it. You heard it here first. But the way our electoral system is constituted, it's extremely difficult for that to take place. And we've had third party efforts that have, in some cases, been very destructive, as I would say Ralph Nader's effort was.
But, you know, let me just ask Elaine to jump in here. But, Elaine, you know, if it's McCain, it's coming out of the Republican Party. I think the questioner was suggesting that why isn't that third party emerging on the left?
I think the system is so stacked now in terms of the political system, where it's set up, and the kinds of money and resources it takes to really get something viable going in terms of the way the rules are written and the whole thing. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be done. But, you know, it's so clear to me. I don't see why they can't say that. The Democratic Party thinks that if they move more to the right, they can pick off some of that votes and no support. The Republicans got that locked up. And they've got that locked up. The idea is to move over to the left and educate people and really, really show that there's a distinction. Because, you know, one way you could say, well, they're losing anyhow. They might as well go on the high road and educate people and take on the issues and really have some discussion. But,
All right. I'm just go right ahead.
Yes, hello. I was watching an episode of Bill Maher the other night, and the issue of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans came up, and there is now speculation that the federal government purposely blew up the levees there in order to kill African Americans who dominated the region. I thought this was a little far-fetched at the time, but as an African American, to me, it doesn't seem that far-fetched now with what this government has done to African Americans over the years. I just wanted to hear your opinions on this, Mrs. Jones and Mr. Williams.
I think it's rubbish. I'm so sorry that you would buy into that. I don't think that there's any evidence of that. And it initially came forward because there was such an incident, and this, I don't want to go into the history, but back in the 20s, of levees being broken up. But I think that in the present format, I think it's really a result of paranoia. And, anyway, go ahead. I think you know how I feel about this.
Well, it's hard to believe the level of incompetence. I know, it's mind-boggling. and I understand. So you look for some other reason, I'm been looking for another reason. But it's the level of incompetence is mind-boggling. And that's what we saw. That's what we saw. And we also, and circumstances, economic circumstances, had disproportionate numbers of African Americans in the low-lying areas. You see, and so you had the economics coupled with the incompetence is what we see. And so the question, so we do have to deal with the issues of poverty, and it goes right back to opportunity and education. All right, but I don't think we do anything for ourselves if we spend time thinking of a massive conspiracy to eliminate black people, despite Bill Bennett's comments.
All right, another question.
I don't want to start any trouble in the Edelman household, but Mr.
I gave up cigars.
No. It has to do with the deracialization of the conversation of civil rights. And the comments that Mr. Edelman was making, I'm not suggesting that he was a proponent of the deracialization, but the comments that you made had to do with the criminalization of African Americans and removing, in terms of the even the welfare discussion, removing issues of race or identifying them as issues of race. And Ms. Wright Edelman, her comments had largely to do with the issues of poverty and education and addressing them as such, it seems, without talking about race. And my question is whether or not we can reinvigorate the civil rights movement without reintroducing discussion in race terms, and if so, should we?
All right, let me just ask for a brief answer from Marion and Peter.
I think we're not in disagreement.
It's
it's the dangerous intersection of race and poverty that we have got to address, which is what the Cradle to Prison pipeline is all about, and we're going to be issuing a very major report on that. But I want to just say to the young man about conspiracy and Katrina, I am very upset about the disparate, continued chaos and incompetence and the denial of very basic supports to Katrina victims. And Grassley Baucus are the failure of us, of our nation, to respond to the health and mental health needs in a quick and a concerted manner is intolerable. 13 days after September 11th, we had disaster relief Medicaid. Our president and Republican leaders in Congress have been opposing a bipartisan bill to break through the red tape and get health care out to these Katrina victims, and I just hope that everybody will make themselves heard. It's very hard not to feel that people are deliberately trying to deny poor black people help when we have such disparate treatment between what we're doing now for Katrina survivors and what happened after September 11th. And so we need to get with it, and we need to hold our government accountable for helping these survivors.
Next question.
I want to answer the young man's question. The government knew what would happen if such a storm would hit all New Orleans. It had been predicted by scientists on the computer, and they were told exactly what would happen, and it happened. So it is the fault, and they didn't listen. But I didn't come to say that. I came to say that I have lived long enough to see the change in the poor of this country, from just black poor to poor of Asian, old women, Latinos, anybody who cannot make a living. They cannot get a job that they can live on. And somehow the civil rights of the poor have been being taken away from us. And somehow we've got to get them back.
Okay. Let me ask this young lady to ask her question.
Something we've heard a lot today is the word race. And I was wondering how, like, everyone defines race differently. Like, the government might define race as being black or white. And, like, I would have trouble defining myself there because I am Latino and I don't define myself as black or white. I define myself as, you know, Hispanic woman. So my question to you is, how do you guys define race, first of all? And should we just have one race, and should that race just be the human race? Because in essence, isn't that what we all are?
Yeah. Elaine, I want you to answer that one.
Well, definitely when I speak of race in this country, I'm talking about those who are not in the majority who disproportionately get the negative end of our laws, and Latinos are definitely included in that. I mean, the Legal Defense Fund has co-counseled with MALDEF and LULAC on lots of cases. You know, so should we all only have one race? That would be wonderful if we could get there. That would be wonderful, and maybe we can use, but our present laws as they're written, the civil rights laws, you know, it includes ethnic and racial minorities. And that's why when we talk about this question of poverty, I'd love to try to put together, you know, a class action suit and go on the issue. But, you know, where's the jurisdictional basis? I mean, Supreme Court's not going to, poverty is not a protected class in the United States.
It ought to be.
It should be, but it's something to work, but it's not there. I mean, we ran against that in the 1973 case. What was it? Rodriguez, you know, so the court has declined to go there, but it does need to go there, and that
that may be something we need to push for to see if we can get a protected class of those who are impoverished, but I'm not optimistic.
But when it comes to racial categorization, isn't it part of an effort by civil rights leaders to protect it, to continue to have the government ask people to classify themselves in that way?
Yes, that's the reason for it, to make sure, you know, they say, well, I'm insulted on the census, you know, we're all one. But you've got some laws in place, and they were put in place in the 60s that protect folk. And to make sure that you are included in that protection is very important to answer those census applications. I've got a Latino mother, you know, white father. I've got, I'm this, I'm that. I mean, it seemed like a chessboard, and that, but to make, get the advantage of our laws, we just have to play the game for now. And then we have to think through what, how we crack through this question of poverty, which is a condition that affects us all across the board.
Can I just say one sentence in response to your question as well as the one before, which is it's a paradox. We need two kinds of politics. We need a politics of the common good. We need a politics of all the things that we share as people in this country that are problems, because there's a huge number of them, and to break them down, whether it's between men and women, whether it's between people of different races and ethnicities and gay and straight and disabled and so on and so forth, gets in the way of that. But the paradox is we need all of that identity as well, and we shouldn't lose it, because we need to make progress about the disabled. We need to make progress about sexual orientation. We need to continue to confront race and ethnicity and put it out on the table. And the challenge is, how do we do both of those things at the same time?
Very quickly, your last question.
Yeah. This is for Peter Edelman, and it has to do with your welfare position several years ago and your closeness to the Clintons. Maybe it's to both Edelman. I'm 66, the most discouraging time in my entire life politically. Last year's election, most extraordinary. I mean, these people.
But you got to ask us a question.
Well,
we're out of time.
All right. Well, I want to set the stage, you know? And I want everybody in this room to go out and tell somebody that Bush is a criminal maniac, you know? I mean, this war, how do you deal with it? I was listening earlier at the hopefulness that people were speaking. Where is the hopefulness?
All right, let's
I've
do
been
that.
A Democratic Party activist.
All right, this is for Mr. Edelman. Where is the hopefulness?
Right here in this room and all across this country.
All right. I want to say thank you to Marion Wright Edelman, to Elaine Jones, and to Peter Edelman. Please.
Thank you so much for my service on the RFK Memorial Foundation Board. I thank you very much for that.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.